first a story, and I'll be reading from the book One Hand Clapping, Zen Stories for All Ages by Ralph Martin. The story is called Baby Snake in a Cup. One evening, a man was invited to the home of a friend. As he was about to drink a cup of tea that was offered to him, he thought he saw a baby snake in the cup. He did not want to embarrass his hostess, so he gathered all of his courage and swallowed the tea in one gulp. When the man returned home later that night, he began to feel severe pains in his stomach. By the next day, the pains had grown worse. He consulted several doctors and tried many cures, but none worked. The man, now seriously ill, thought he was about to die. Hearing of his condition, his friend invited him to visit her once again. Sitting in the same place, he accepted another cup of tea. As the sick man lifted his cup to drink, he suddenly saw the snake again. This time he had to speak up, so he drew his hostess's attention to it. Without a word, she pointed to the ceiling above her guest. He looked up. There, just above him, hanging from a beam, was a length of rope. The sick man realized all at once that what he had thought was a baby snake was simply the reflection of the rope. The two friends looked at each other and laughed. The pain of the sick man vanished instantly, and he recovered perfect health. That is the end of the story. And now I'll be reading from the book and commenting on us. The book is called The Unborn, The Life and Teachings of Zen Master Bankei. Zen Master Bankei lived from 1622 to 1693. And that was a long time ago in Japan. And my teacher does this, and I really appreciate when he does. Just to give a historical perspective, he will let us know what else was going on in America and in the world during the time that some of these teachers from way back were teaching and were living. And so, I'm doing the same. Okay, during the 1600s, in America here, the colonies of Jamestown, Virginia, and the Massachusetts Bay colonies were established. Also during that century, a Dutch ship brought the first African slaves to British North America. In England, the King James Bible was published. The French colony of Quebec was established. And the Taj Mahal was completed. It was a pretty momentous century. So I'm going to start reading, and then I'll comment here and there. And I'll be skipping around, obviously. Not a single one of you people at this meeting is unenlightened. Right now, you're all sitting before me as Buddhas. Each of you received the Buddha mind from your mothers when you were born and nothing else. This inherited Buddha mind is beyond any doubt unborn, with a marvelously bright, illuminative wisdom. In the unborn, all things are perfectly resolved. I can give you proof that they are. While you're facing me, listening to me speak like this, if a crow cawed or a sparrow chirped or some other sound occurred somewhere behind you, you would have no difficulty knowing it was a crow or a sparrow or whatever, even without giving a thought to listening to it, because you're listening by means of the unborn. If a sparrow chirps behind you, you don't mistake it for a crow. You don't mistake the sound of a bell for that of a drum, or hear a man's voice and take it for a woman's, or take an adult's voice for a child's. You hear and distinguish those different sounds without making a single mistake by virtue of the marvelous working of illuminative wisdom. Further, he says, none of you could say that you heard the sounds because you had made up your minds to hear them beforehand. All of you are looking this way, intent upon hearing me. You're concentrating single-mindedly on listening. There's no thought in any of your minds to hear the sounds or noises that might occur behind you. You are able to hear and distinguish sounds when they do occur without consciously intending to hear them, because you're listening by means of the unborn Buddha mind. When people are firmly convinced that the Buddha mind is unborn and wonderfully illuminating and live in it, they're Buddhas and living Tathagatas from then on. This unborn Buddha mind, Zen Master Bankei calls the unborn, it goes by many names. It's original mind, primary mind, mind with a capital M. It's known as true nature, Buddha, self with a capital S, self nature. They're all referring to the same thing. Even in the Zen koans, these enigmatic puzzles, it is what is pointed to when is the questions are asked, who am I? That's one of the koans. What is mu? And who is the master of seeing and hearing? All of these are referred, are all talking about this unborn Buddha mind. Elsewhere, Bankei says this. Now, you're probably all wondering what this unborn Buddha mind is like. The Buddha mind, unborn and illuminating all things with perfect clarity, is like a mirror standing clear and spotlessly polished. A mirror, as you know, reflects anything that's before it. Whatever's placed in front of it never fails to be reflected, though the mirror has no idea or intention of doing so. And when the object is taken away, the mirror doesn't reflect it any longer, though it makes no decision to cease reflecting. Now that's just how the unborn Buddha mind works. You see and hear all things, no matter what they are, although you haven't generated a single thought to see or hear them. Because of the vital workings of the unborn Buddha mind, each of you received at birth. And he goes on to talk about how each of us received his unborn Buddha minds at birth. So-called good people, and so-called evil people, people of every stripe. At that time, and even today, I hear that it was thought that because of the heavy karmic burden of women, that women could not attain Buddhahood. And so he addresses that particular notion. This is what he says. Suppose that outside the temple walls, someone started to beat on a drum or strike a bell. When you heard those sounds, would the women here mistake the drum beat for the bell, or the bell for the drum beat? No. as far as hearing those sounds is concerned, no difference exists between the men and the women. It's not only true of men and women. There are people of all kinds in this hall, old people and young, priests and laity, and so on. But there wouldn't be any difference in the way that a young person or a monk or a layman heard the sounds either. The place in which there's no difference in the hearing of those sounds is the unborn, the Buddha mind, and it's perfectly equal and absolutely the same in each one of you. When we say, this is a man or this is a woman, those designations result from the arising of thought. They come afterward. At the place of the unborn, before the thought arises, attributes such as man or woman don't even exist. That should make it clear that there's no distinction between men's Buddha minds and women's. There's no reason then to doubt about women having Buddha minds. Each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe, and everyone in this world of humans as well, has been endowed with it. But being ignorant of the fact that you have a Buddha mind, you live in illusion. Why is it you're deluded? Because you're partial to yourself. And this self-partiality is what separates us from our true nature, from our Buddha minds. We encounter the world. We develop our preferences, and we act on those preferences. And we create illusion for ourselves. I'll read a dialogue between a Zen Master Bankei and a monk on this particular subject. A monk said to Bankei, I was born with a short temper. It's always flaring up. I know I should do something about it, but as I was born with a bad temper, I'm unable to rid myself of it no matter how hard I try. Is there anything I can do to correct it? Bankei, that's an interesting inheritance you have. Is your temper here now? Bring it out and I'll cure it for you. Monk, I'm not angry now. My temper comes on unexpectedly when something provokes me. Bankei, you weren't born with it then. You create it yourself when some pretext or other happens to appear. You work yourself into a temper because of your partiality for yourself, opposing others in order to have your own way. Each person receives the Buddha mind from his parents when he's born. His illusion is something he produces all alone by being partial to himself. When you don't produce your temper, where is it? All illusions are the same. As long as you don't produce them, they cease to exist. That's what everyone fails to realize. Fix this clearly in your head. When you're not deluded, you are a Buddha, and that means you are enlightened. There's no other way for you to become a Buddha. So draw close and listen carefully and be sure that you understand what I say. You create your outburst of temper when the organs of your six senses, the six senses, by the way, in Buddhism, there's six senses, the five ordinary senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And then the sixth sense is that of the faculty of mind, thinking. You create your outburst of temper when the organs of your six senses are stimulated by some external condition and incite you to oppose other people because you desire to assert your own preciously held ideas. When you have no attachment to self, there are no illusions. All your parents gave you when you were born was a Buddha mind, nothing else. From the time you were a tiny baby, you've watched and listened to people losing their tempers around you. You've been schooled in this until you too have become habituated to irascibility. So now you indulge in frequent fits of anger. Right now, if you realize you've been mistaken and don't allow that temper of yours to arise anymore, you'll have no temper to worry about. Instead of trying to correct it, don't produce it in the first place. Once you realize this and you stop creating that temper of yours, you'll find that you won't have any other illusions either, not even if you want to. For you'll be living constantly in the unborn Buddha mind. Don't allow your temper to arise anymore. Then you'll have no temper to worry about. Interesting story. I have a really good friend who, because of health reasons, was told he needed to lose a bit of weight. And this friend looked at this as a life or death situation. And so he was very serious about losing weight. He'd never attempted to lose weight. He'd never felt like he ever really needed to. And so he researched different things and decided that he was going to start counting calories. And so that's what he did. He assigned himself a certain amount of calories for each day, and he tried to make sure that he didn't go over these certain number of calories. And in addition to that, he continued his research on diet, exercise, nutrition, all while counting calories. And gradually, he lost the weight that he needed to lose. And just recently, he told me that he can never go back to how he was. And what I understood that to mean and how he explained it to me was that he knows too much now. And it's not just what he learned in his research, but he experimented on his own body. He found that certain foods gave him more energy. Certain other foods gave him less. Some foods made him feel really good in his body, and other foods didn't make him feel as good. These are all things that he learned by living this diet he was on. He learned his own food heritage, why he eats when he does and how much he does. And this is why he says he can't go back. Yes, he could probably, just like many people, ignore what he knows and regain the weight. But he can't unlearn what he's learned. He can't unknow what he knows. He has gone from knowing with a small k to knowing with a capital K. knowing it in his body, because he's embodied this, this knowledge. And that's why he can never go back. When Zen Master Bankei says, once you've realized this and you stop creating that temper of yours, or in my friend's case, you've stopped overeating, you'll find that you won't have any other illusions either. This friend can't deceive himself anymore. He can ignore what he knows, but he can't deceive himself. When Bankei says here, don't allow your temper to arise anymore, you'll have no temper to worry about. For my friend, I'm sure he would agree if it said, don't allow overeating to arise anymore, and then you won't have to worry about overeating. But this is true, not with just physical habits, but with mental habits as well. And all of this is all mental habits. It is the thoughts and the condition of the mind is what informs our actions and our speech. If we don't think it, we don't speak it, we don't do it. And so, our goal is to be aware of what we're doing, to be aware of where our minds are going, to be aware of where our minds are. Another question. Every time I clear a thought from my mind, another appears right away. Thoughts keep appearing like that without end. What can I do about them? Bankei. Clearing thoughts from the mind as they arise is like washing away blood in blood. You may succeed in washing away the original blood, but you're still polluted by the blood you washed in. No matter how long you keep washing, the blood stains never disappear. Since you don't know that your mind is originally unborn and undying and free of illusion, you think that your thoughts really exist. You have to realize that your thoughts are ephemeral and unreal, and without either clutching at them or rejecting them, just let them come and go of themselves. They're like images reflected in a mirror. A mirror is clear and bright and reflects whatever is placed before it. But the image doesn't remain in the mirror. The Buddha mind is 10,000 times brighter than any mirror and is marvelously illuminative besides. All thoughts vanish tracelessly into its light. He says here, you have to realize that your thoughts are ephemeral and unreal without clutching them or rejecting them. In Zen, we do that through Zazen. Zazen literally means sitting meditation. And it refers not just to this seated meditation that we're doing right now, but it also refers to what we do in our everyday lives. In general, it refers to what the mind is doing, that the mind is sitting with whatever the body is doing. The two are in accord. Zen, we're given instructions for whatever method that we're doing, There are different methods in Zen. There's working with the breath, whether it's counting different aspects of the breath or following the breath or awareness of the breath. And then there's koans and shikantaza, which is like vipassana. And all of the methods in Zen all have the same things in common. We are instructed to remain with our practice. Whether we're moving, whether we're sitting, the body and mind are one. When thoughts come into the mind, which of course they do, we are instructed to remain with the practice, whatever it is that we're doing. And what happens, and we can't force this to happen, is that we see the way our minds work. We see our patterns. We see our habits. We see the thoughts as they come in. We see the thoughts as they leave. And we learn that we don't have to think the thoughts that come into the mind. Just like we don't have to listen to the sounds that we hear. And we don't have to watch everything that parades in front of our eyes. We don't have to think everything that comes into our minds. When thoughts arise, return to this moment. They come up again, return to the moment. We don't have to mess with them. We don't have to push them away. We don't have to grab at them. Just remain in this moment, to not be separated from it. One final quote, and this is from Zen Master Bhanke, summing up our practice. This is what he says. The essence of our school is expressed in the saying, and he gives this saying, if there is even a hair breadth of difference, you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. And that's the end of the saying. And this is what he comments. At the instant in a Zen encounter, when two minds move without separation, it is like two mirrors reflecting each other. Each and everything is presented in true suchness. Each and everything is completely true. There is nothing above to catch hold of, and nothing below to support you. You live in your original perfection, unborn and undying, immersed in a samadhi of total freedom, where nothing, not even stone walls, can hinder you. You must realize that it is your own views and opinions that obstruct you. It is no different with the words I'm speaking to you now. If I give you a word of explanation and you cling to it, you go hopelessly astray. It is best not to stop or abide anywhere.